From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Facebook, Twitter, Skype, Pinterest. There are a whole lot of tools we use to connect with each other these days. We invent them, but do you ever wonder, how are they inventing us?
When and how did you take a job as a social scientist at Facebook?
I just thought spending time at Facebook would be ideal just because I study information diffusion and networks, and there's practically no better place to study that than on Facebook.
Laura Adamek is one of a host of social scientists working at Facebook. Anne Strainchamps wanted to know why and what all those sociologists are up to.
So can you use Facebook as a giant social laboratory and actually run kind of controlled social experiments on it?
Yes. So there have been several examples of this. One of them was voting. So this was during the 2010 congressional elections, and Robert Bond and James Fowler and others looked at how you might be swayed to vote. And so some users, some fraction of the users, would see at the top of their Facebook feed a box that would have, you know, running statistics about the number of Facebook users who have reported voting. They themselves could click a button saying, I voted, so they would be added to that tally. And then optionally, they could click through to see what their closest voting place was. And also optionally, so in one condition, they would be shown which of their friends had voted, up to six of their friends, if six or more of their friends had voted, which ones had voted. And then other users in another condition might not see anything at all, or they might see simply the voting information without seeing that their friends had clicked on the I voted button.
So you had these three groups, including one control group that saw nothing additional.
Yes.
What did you find out?
Not only did it make a difference that you saw that your friends have voted, but specifically it made a difference if it was your strong ties, whose little profile pictures you saw.
Was Facebook able to look at that and say there was greater turnout?
Yes, but again, kind of in a very privacy-preserving way. So there was no direct lookup of records, but rather matching in a hash crypto way how many people turned out in a given area and how many had seen the encouragement on Facebook.
So the thing that interests me about that is that it's the concept of using the power of peer influence or peer pressure for social good.
Yes. So some of it is for social good. Some of it is maybe for just well-being. So there was another experiment that would modify the prompt for a status update. Instead of asking what's on your mind, it would, around Thanksgiving or on Thanksgiving Day, it would ask, what are you thankful for? And the idea there was, again, some users would see the what are you thankful for version and others would just see the regular prompt. And then the question was not just whether those who would see the prompt asking what are you thankful for, whether they would express gratitude, but whether friends of those users would then see their friend being thankful and then similarly post such updates. So it's clear that social networks are there not just for propagating information, but also because we can influence each other's behavior. And so it's nice to see that a platform such as Facebook can actually facilitate that.
It's both fascinating and, frankly, it's also a little terrifying. I mean, the potential for social engineering must be huge. As a social scientist, does that worry you?
I think it's a concern and something that Facebook is very careful and mindful of. So there's no intent to do really anything of the sort. So the most of the focus is on making the product better, and then the kind of academic studies tend to focus on the positive aspects, again, voting, organ donation, etc.
Didn't I read that not long ago, Facebook also used its data to analyze gross national happiness on a country-by-country basis?
So there was a study, this was done by Adam Kramer on the data science team, that did this just for the United States. And again, it's using data in aggregate, essentially automatically going through all status updates and in the very simple way, practically looking at the counts of positive versus negative sentiment words. So in that way, what Adam found was that on holidays, typically, so Thanksgiving, Christmas, 4th of July, people are on average happier. When sad events happen, for example, Michael Jackson dying, people are on average less happy. He saw weekly trends, so Friday ended up being the happiest day.
And in principle,
right, in principle, one could do this in different countries. This was more a convenient thing, you know, because it was in English and there are extensive sentiment word dictionaries for English. But there isn't really a reason why one couldn't do this globally.
It must be tempting to think about doing something with that kind of information. I mean, I guess this is where people also get a little scared by Facebook's power to crunch this kind of data. I mean, imagine that, well, I can imagine, for example, just that data on happiness would be potentially worth money to a drug company that was manufacturing antidepressants.
Well, I don't really see in what sense. I mean, perhaps if they wanted, well, first of all, they wouldn't get the Facebook data, but maybe, you know, they should focus their advertising on Mondays or something like that.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
And there has been other research, not using Facebook data, but rather using Twitter data that has tried to tie sentiment to stock market indices and things of that sort. And I think the jury's still out on that.
There must be conversation inside Facebook, I would imagine, extensive conversation about exactly this issue, you know, monetizing data and the ethics of that. And as a social scientist, it must be interesting to you to watch or listen to that discussion. Like, what's the ethical line? You know, is this an ethical use of our data? And is that an unethical use? What's that conversation like?
So I think when we talk about use of data, we're primarily interested in something that might pass the institutional review board at a university. So basically that there's just no adverse effect to the users. And so far, our focus has been just exclusively on, you know, improving user experience. So not not kind of extracurricular projects.
You know, Facebook itself, I think, has said that because of Facebook, the world is a better place. People have more friends. Is there actual data to prove that?
Traditionally, what has been kind of argued, and Robin Dunbar is a key figure in this, is that there are limits to how many friends one can have. You could have up to 4 or 5 close friends and maybe 150 other individuals with whom you have a reciprocal relationship where you stay in touch. Now, I do believe that Facebook has expanded this number. About 15% of users do have above 500 friends. And so you might wonder, oh, okay, are those real friends? But those very same users who have more weak ties also tend to have more strong ties on Facebook. So I think Facebook is actually revealing that some individuals just have higher capacity. In addition, it's not as if on Facebook you have to interact with all of your friends equally. So a study by Lars Backstrom and others at Facebook showed that about 60% of your directed communication, so when you comment or when you message or when you post to someone's timeline, that falls within the top 15 individuals on your list, the top 15 with whom you communicate the most. But if you look at your content consumption, so when you view users' profiles, your friends' profiles, or when their stories appear in your newsfeed, that is much more distributed. So only about 20 to 30% of that attention is allocated to the top 15. So Facebook is allowing you to stay in in touch and to know what's going on with a broader circle of friends while allowing you to maintain those strong ties that you then directly communicate with and interact with frequently.
And going from there to the question of how Facebook might be changing habits of social interaction and the ways we get along with people, and on the one hand, that seems great, right? That more friendship in the world. What could possibly be wrong with that? And on the other hand, I guess I wonder if that also means there's more potential for peer pressure or groupthink.
So I think what our studies have shown so far is that, if anything, Facebook brings more diversity. So in looking at the information that you're exposed to and then the information that you reshare, one hypothesis would be that, well, you'll tend to reshare information that you already tend to agree with, and you'll tend to associate with friends who are like-minded, and so they will feed you this information that you're already likely to.
So we'll sort ourselves into communities that are similar.
Right, but what we found was very much the opposite. It's true that your strong ties are more like you, but the vast majority of the information that reaches you is from your weak ties, which really diversifies your information exposure. And then when you look at what information you tend to reshare, yes, an individual item that's shared by a strong tie, you're more likely to reshare. But in aggregate, you actually end up resharing more content from your weak ties. So through this nice feature that Facebook makes it easy to stay in touch with so many people, it also diversifies the information you consume and then the information that you also share with your other friends.
And Strange Champs talking with Lotta Adamek, a data scientist at Facebook. And speaking of Facebook, like us, friend us, comment on us on our Facebook page. You can link to it at ttbook.org. This is a tape recording of poetry from Somalia. It was recorded on a cassette tape, remember those? And passed from hand to hand, person to person, across the country. Somalia didn't have a written language until the 1970s, and today many, if not most, Somalis still live within an oral tradition. Alexander Stiller writes about the power of Somali poetry in his book The Future of the Past. He told Steve Paulson that one of the country's most esteemed poets is a man named Hadrawi.
He is revered as one of the great poets of Somalia, and particularly because of his role in the movement of opposition to the dictatorship of Siad Barre in the 1970s and 1980s. The thing that is extraordinary about the story of poetry and writing in Somalia is that writing wasn't introduced until about 1972 by Siad Barre, the dictator who came to power in 1969. And he decided to introduce the Latin script as the written language for Somalia. Unfortunately, because he also wanted to use writing for political purposes and to use it as a way of enforcing his power, controlling the press, and making people read, you know, propagandistic statements of his regime, opposition to his regime took the form of oral poetry because it was, one, a traditional way of communicating, and it was also free of his control.
That's a wonderful thought, that the poets rise up to oppose the dictator, that poetry still matters in the modern world.
Poetry really matters in Somalia, and what I found particularly extraordinary and the reason why I pursued this, it wasn't just an opposition between writing and oral poetry, but you had, entering into the mix, the inexpensive tape recorder. And the inexpensive tape recorder arrived at just about the same time writing was introduced, and it amplified this traditional, you know, medium of oral poetry and gave it a voice and a degree of circulation that it had never had before. So these poets like Hadrawi were reciting their poetry onto cassette, or in many cases their poetry was being put to music and sung by famous singers, and they had the circulation and the popularity, you know, of pop songs. Imagine, you know, being an intellectual with the reach into people's households of Madonna or Michael Jackson. And that's the particular status that poets in that society enjoy. And so he became, you know, universally known to Somalis in this period through his poetry.
I know you have some samples of Hadrawi's poetry. Could you read one of his poems?
Sure. One, for example, that got him into a great deal of trouble in 1973, the dictator Siad Barre was in fact very interested in poetry, had a huge collection apparently of tapes, but was very concerned about the power of the poets and his inability to control them. And he called Hadrawi into his office and he said, you know, ask me whatever you want, any job you want, but just don't write poetry against us. And Hadrawi was very offended by this, and he wrote a poetic play called The She-Camel, in which one of the episodes is that he describes the slaughter of a feast that is enjoyed by only a few while the multitude of people watch from a distance. And it was a pretty clear reference to anyone in Somalia to the growing corruption and cronyism of the Siad Barre government. And one of the poems seems to allude to a struggle ahead, and it goes, "With the news of a slaughtered she-camel, everybody hurried to the scene. The fun will be to see the others who saw the smoke from the high peaks and will come rushing down the slopes and the ridges. Laughter is a crime. The hero gave his neck. In the shed there was a snake." At another point, the poem included a kind of reference to Siad Barre's attempt to buy him off, and he says, "I will not eat the demeaning scraps from your table." And so it was a real challenge to Siad Barre, and Hadrawi was arrested, and he was forced to live for several years under a kind of house arrest after that.
Isn't there also a Somali tradition of a poetic chain where poets actually compete with each other?
Yeah, in a way, it's sort of like the modern-day poetry slam, but in Somali, it's an ancient tradition. And the way it works is this. A poet starts a chain, or a duel, as they sometimes call it, by writing a poem on a certain theme using a particular alliterative scheme. In Somalia, poetry doesn't rhyme at the end of each line, but it uses alliteration so that, let's say, they'll start a poem that begins with B, and that letter will be repeated frequently in certain ways throughout the poem. Hadrawi participated in two very historically important poetic duels, the first in the mid-70s, and then in 1981, he and a close friend, also a great poet, known as Garia, they became totally fed up with the Siad Barre regime. And after Hadrawi was released from his house arrest, conditions in Somalia were going from bad to worse. Siad Barre had involved Somalia in a disastrous war with Ethiopia, which Somalia lost, causing an enormous refugee crisis and the famine that brought Somalia to the attention of much of the rest of the world in the 1980s. So all this was in motion, and Hadrawi and Garia decided that they really had to do something. So they said, we've got to respond to the situation. And so they started a poetic chain. And what was incredible was that it started and literally hundreds of poets responded. Poems began coming in from every country around the world where Somali refugees are living. And overwhelmingly, they were negative about the Siad Barre regime. And when the regime realized it couldn't stop the circulation and the proliferation of these cassettes and poems, it became clear that they had sort of lost control of public opinion, and organized resistance to his regime started shortly thereafter.
Can you give me a feel of how this works, a recording?
Sure. Well, I have a recording of a poet named Abdi Gais, who lived in Djibouti, who responded to Hadrawi in one of these poetic chains. Many of these duels are conducted in a kind of metaphorical language, which is open to an enormous interpretation. And so Adrawi insists that some of his earlier work, which was not political, was given a political meaning because people were so hungry for political information, political knowledge during the period of the dictatorship. And then only later he did work that was clearly very openly political.
Alexander Stiller's book is The Future of the Past. Steve Paulson spoke with him. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Some time ago, Olga Nunez got an invitation to join an email listserv of more than 21,000 artists. The rules of the listserv are simple. Every day, one person on the list is randomly selected to write an email and send it to everyone else. So when it's your turn, what do you write? Olga Nunez knew exactly what she wanted to do, and Strange Champs asked her to read the email she sent out.
Call this number, 415-857-0589. It leads to a Google voicemail box. You can call it from anywhere. When you call, you'll be asked a question. Answer it.
So what happened when they called that number? What did they hear?
When they called that number, they heard a sort of lead-in where I was trying to walk them through very slowly the experience of how memories are triggered by senses. And at the very end, I asked them to tell me a memory. And I tried to make the question slow enough that so by the time they got to the beep, they weren't surprised and hung up. And actually, most people didn't hang up. Most people just started talking. And you could tell that a lot of people were surprised by the answer they gave by the end of it.
How many people took part in this? How many phone calls did you get?
I mean, last time I counted, it was about 600 people that left voicemails. So there's, you know, maybe 100 more that were super short and got cut off or hung up. But a much smaller percentage of people didn't leave answers than did.
Wow. 600 people. That's a lot.
Yeah. It was a lot to go through. I only got through, I think, 150 or so, and then I had to ask for help.
Well, we've got a small selection here, so let's hear a few of them. I mean, here's one of my favorites.
I live in Princeton, New Jersey, and the memory that I can remember was brought back to me when I went back to my parents' house one summer. And I remember pulling out a box, a shoebox underneath my desk that had postcards and trinkets from high school. And I noticed that there was the small bottle of perfume that my first girlfriend, my first kiss, my first love used to wear. There wasn't much left in the bottle, enough for maybe one more spray, but I opened the cap and the smell just filled me with a sucker punch to the stomach, basically. I just collapsed with the idea of remembering. And yeah, I didn't quite know what to do with myself. And I sat back, I leaned back, and I think I remained motionless while I was trying to remember. And I just stayed there. I just kind of stayed there. And I closed my eyes, and almost as though closing my eyes would keep that memory where it was. Almost as though my closing my eyes would make sure that it wouldn't go away. I know I gave my name and everything, but if you could please just put me as anonymous from Princeton, New Jersey, and don't include her name. Just make up a name. Awesome. I think this is a really cool idea. Good luck with you and your project.
Wow. So right away, that gives you such a taste of people share so much. They get intimate so fast. Did that surprise you?
It kind of did a little, but I think that there's probably a safety in the phone call. Like, we're so used to email and revealing ourselves, and something about calling this anonymous phone number. The thing that was fascinating to me about that one is that he said her name and he said his own name. And you could tell he wasn't expecting to tell that story, because at the end he's like, actually, can you delete this? Because I can't, you know, share that much.
Of course, they're not all so heartfelt. Some are just funny. Like,
yes.
I love this one about the guy who remembers, well, we should play it. The guy who remembers sitting in his mom's car.
It's a memory that it sort of always comes back to me. This is going to seem silly, but I have two brothers, and the memory is driving to soccer practice in my mother's red Volvo station wagon and sitting in the middle seat in between both of my brothers, and I am thrown back into that seat any time I smell either of my brother's farts. Now, I know that may seem like some sort of joke, but I assure you that is the truth. It's not as often that I spend time with them or see them as it was when I was a child. So, you know, every time I get the opportunity to smell one of my brother's farts, I really cherish it. thank you. Calling from New York, Brooklyn, but the memory comes from growing up in San Diego, California.
Yeah, that one's just that was just hilarious.
Most of them actually don't end up being funny. Like, some of them end up being lighthearted, but they tend to go sort of more personal, and there's only a couple that are really, really funny that make you giggle. It's interesting. I was going to say, I guess the harder memories in print more strongly than the funny ones.
Huh. It strikes me some of the most memorable ones they're kind of heartbreaking. They're memories of things, smells I think people would probably rather forget. I'm thinking of the one you called green soap.
Yep, yep, exactly.
It's the smell of green soap. Whenever I smell green soap, like I did last week, I flash back almost 50 years ago to when I was a child going to the dentist. From the ages 7 to 9, the dentist sexually molested me. So every time I'm around that green soap smell, I turn back into that frightened 7-year-old. And my heart pounds. My name is Suzanne, and I'm in the Washington, D.C. area.
Wow. The first time I heard that, that's when it hit me. How powerful your project is. I mean, these aren't just sweet or nice or funny scent memories. They're really primal.
Yeah.
Why is that, do you think?
I don't know. I'm a person who's constantly tripping over my own past, and I feel like most people do it. Maybe they just don't do it nearly as consciously. And it may be that there are things that, you know, either we forget or try to forget. And some music or sense of smell will come and trip us, and we'll end up right back there.
Yeah, it's like getting ambushed by a smell.
Yeah, yes, exactly, exactly.
You know, a memory that maybe you don't even remember, know that you have, gets triggered completely out of the blue. Like there's another one called disorienting.
Mm-hmm.
The last strong memory I had that was triggered by a sense was a smell, and I walked into a room and smelled what I always assumed was carpet. Only it wasn't just carpet, it was just a specific carpet sound, and I walked in, and I was transported back to my 5th grade classroom, which had the exact same carpet smell, and I was 11 years old again, and I looked around and I looked for my friends because I was there. It was really disorienting, actually. So, but yes, it was a smell. It was the smell of carpet.
Does it make you feel different if you're, I don't know, you're out and about and you're in a crowd? Do you look around at other people and think each one of these people has a story?
Yes. Yes, entirely. That is a perfect description.
What I'm wondering is, do you feel differently about strangers, about being in the world now?
Yeah, I think I do. I think so much of us, you know, walking around as people, we're very, very guarded. And I think that we actually are all stories, that we're all walking around with these sort of beautiful and lavish internal narratives that we never really get a chance to say or externalize. So I think more than anything, it's exciting to know that there's a way to kind of unlock people and get them to start telling you those stories and to feel very strongly that everyone has these inside them.
The technology that surrounds us can so often we see it as dehumanizing in some mm-hmm. way or another. And I just have to say, the thing I really love about your project is that you're taking this simple everyday technology that we all use and you're using it for these profoundly humanistic reasons. I mean, it feels like you figured out a way to create a gigantic art project with perfect strangers. I mean, make something beautiful together.
I'm so glad you think that. That's fantastic.
Can we end with one more?
Sure.
We have to end with the story of the girl on the escalator in Madrid. I love that one.
I love that one too.
My name is Heather, and I'm in Washington, D.C. When I was a senior in college, I spent about 3 months in Spain teaching English and working with a missionary family there. And it was three of the worst months of my life. I hated just about every minute, and I missed my family, and I missed my friends, and I missed my boyfriend, and I just felt so alone. And one day, I was riding the metro home, and as I was leaving the metro station, I got on the escalator behind this old woman, and she smelled exactly like my grandmother, who is one of the most important people in my life. And I almost cried standing there riding this escalator in the middle of Madrid because I felt so homesick and nostalgic, but at the same time, I felt so loved and safe. And as we got off the metro, I had to fight the deep urge to ask this complete stranger if I could hug her because to me, she smelled like love.
That's beautiful.
It's so good.
Can our listeners take part?
Yes. Yes, of course. I'd love for them to.
So what do we do?
All you would do is call the number, which is 415-857-0589.
Okay. And leave a message.
Yep.
Did you get it? 415-857-0589. We'll put your voicemails on our website at ttbook.org. Olga Nunez told Anne Strangechamps that she was so inspired by this project, she's writing an album based on it. You're listening to one of her songs right now. It's called Waiting For.
You're pushing hard to make the right decision. You're driving too fast to see.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Connected, but sometimes people want to keep their connections private. Take, for instance, a politician who doesn't want to seem connected to a certain lobbyist, or a corporation that doesn't want the public to know who's on their board. In Chile, a new platform called Poderopedia has just been launched, and its goal is to make those connections more transparent. It's a crowdsourced map of business and political power in Chile. Journalist Miguel Paz founded Poderopedia.
Basically, Jim, what we do is that we create a small basic profile, and afterwards we add all sorts of connections that are worthwhile for people to understand. As an example, you have to understand that in the U.S. you had the debate of the 1%. In Chile, it's actually 0.1%. There's five schools where 50% or a little more of of the politicians and businessmen went to those schools. So who's your family? What's your last name? Who are your relatives? Where did you study? At what university did you attend to? Are you a member of a political party or not? Do you own a company? Do you own a lot more than one company? Do you give money to foundations? To which foundations? Are you a member of a private club or a religious group? Those are all the things that we try to track. And we try to track also the connections between the most influential people, companies, and institutions. So let's say, for example, our president owns a helicopter with a businessman who happens to be a really good friend of his. And that same businessman is the owner of one of the biggest tech companies in the country that is also a technology provider for the government. And he's also one of the investors of the startup of one of the sons of the president. So those are the things that we try to map and show using public information, information that has been published by media, and also information that gets sent by Politopedia users that we check before posting.
Can I ask you a practical question? Where Yes. does this information come from? You talk about people sending it in. You talk about, on the website, you talk about crowdsourcing. But I'm not sure that I understand who has the ability to offer information to Politopedia and how you make sure it's accurate information.
For example, I'm not going to say the name of the person because I don't want to embarrass him, but one high-profile member of the government spent one entire day sending information about his profile because he saw that his profile didn't have enough information. And for us, that's actually a good thing, to actually have somebody that is a high-profile person to send that information is important. Of course, we have to be twice as thorough on checking if whatever he's sending or she's sending is true and it's not just a public relation operation. But we receive information from many, many sources, people that work in the government, journalists that sometimes write stories about people or companies and they don't get published in their newspapers. They know that we support, you know, professional secrecy, so they send us that information and we check it again. And there's also basic things like, I suggest a connection between this guy and that guy because those people are related because of this, and showing the source. We always try to help people through the forms that we provide to help them, you know, send information as vetted as possible.
I should think that it would be a kudo for your Politopedia that prominent people want now to make sure that the information about them is on your site. It suggests that people are using it and noting the connections.
Yes, I mean, for us, transparency is a big issue. Politopedia is a tool to promote transparency and a healthier society for everybody. And we don't try to discriminate between, you know, rich people or poor people or influential people or not influential people when it comes to using the platform. We created it with a basic purpose, since we are journalists, to actually save a journalist some time on their fact-checking or on their pre-reporting. But also we created it for citizens to have more information and cut information asymmetry, so they can understand who is who in a matter that affects them.
Speaking of transparency, who is the we that does the checking? When you get new information, you said we check to make sure that it's accurate. Who's we in that sentence?
We, in right now, is two people, because our organization is very small. It's Monica Ventura, who is the chief researcher and the chief content provider in Politopedia. She works on that every day, full time. And the other part of we, it's me, that I spend half of my day writing and adding information to Politopedia and fact-checking information that we receive from our users.
What does it look like when you come to the Politopedia website?
It's kind of like a big directory. It has a front page where we show you a couple of profiles, kind of like a showcase, and then you can browse by person, you can rise by directories of companies or institutions, or you can check from A to Z, and also you can check through connections. And whenever you go to a profile page, you'll have a small profile, like a little biography at the beginning. Then you have a spreadsheet of connections. You know, if this person has a family, has a business, who is connected to, then if it's a big company or a very high profile person, it'll have a longer newsworthy profile. You will also have a map of connections, which is a map that opens up in a new window and shows you all the connections of that person in a more visual way. Also, if there's any documents that are related to that company or the institution or that person, you'll see the documents there. And also you'll see a tab that is about the sources we use for all the information that is being published.
We interviewed Julian Assange not long ago of WikiLeaks. He told us he fears for the well-being of people who work for him. Do you have any fears like that? Are you afraid they'll come after you for doing this?
It is something that concerns us because this year Politopedia will launch an intense campaign of creating Politopedia chapters in other countries. So we're speaking with different organizations from Latin American countries in places where life is very much at risk for journalists, such as Mexico, Central America, Colombia, and Venezuela. So security at that moment will be a top priority, especially for the people who are there. Also, you have to understand that our team and myself, we've been working as journalists and working with information since 15 years. We've already had our shares of liability lawsuits or threats and you know, people getting mad at what we publish and everything. So we're not new in the neighborhood and we're kind of used to those things happening. Of course, in Chile, the higher risk is a lawsuit. In other countries, the really big risk is somebody going by your radio or your house and throwing a bomb from a riding motorcycle.
Politopedia founder Miguel Paz speaking from his office in Chile. You can see an English language demonstration of Politopedia on our website at ttbook.org. In the gaming world, game designer Jason Rohrer is a god. Now, saying someone's a god in a certain field is a figure of speech. I mean, they're not really immortal beings. Well, that is, unless you're Jason Rohrer, as Anne Strainchamps found out.
Jason, you created Chain World for the annual Game Design Challenge back in 2011, and the challenge was to create a game that could also be a religion. So not a game about a religion, but a game that could be a religion?
Right, right. So the games that we were designing couldn't just be about religion, like a game about Buddhism or a game about the existence of God or something like that. They actually had to be a religious practice, as players playing the game would be actually engaging in a religious or spiritual practice.
Well, so describe the game that you came up with, Chain World.
So the game of Chain World is a game that a single person in the world can play at a time. The game ships on a USB stick. It's a single USB stick, a single unique object that serves as sort of the like Ark of the Covenant, the holy object in this religion.
It's the Holy Grail.
The Holy Grail, yes. And this object passes from person to person, but only one person, because it's a physical object, can have it at a time. The entire game is contained on this object. It's an immense 3D world created through the existing game Minecraft, which was a huge hit and phenomenon at the time. So Minecraft is a three-dimensional world that goes on for 8 times the surface area of the Earth and goes 128 meters down if you want to dig into the ground and so on. And you can build all these structures inside of it. But it starts off with a very naturalistic world with caves and mountains and rivers and lakes and oceans and all this kind of stuff that has been untouched. So the very first person in the game gets this untouched world, and they get to go into it and play around in it and build things and dig holes and construct things and try to survive as long as they can. And after they die, the rules of the religion say that they must stop playing at that point, and they must take the USB stick out of their computer and then pass it on to somebody else who expresses interest. So that second person in the religion chain will go in and experience this three-dimensional computer-generated world that has all the naturalistic things that the first person experienced, plus all the things that that person tried to build and achieve while they were trying to survive.
So if you were, say, the 40th person to get this game, you'd have no idea who had played it before, but they would have left their marks on this.
They would have left their mark, and the marks would be potentially decaying or modified, right, by all the 39 people who came between you and them, right? So you come into this world, and is there a city there? Is there crumbling ruins? Is there stuff that's obviously been defaced? What did this mean? What did someone put this here? Does this lead to something that's something hidden? You know, is this an arrow that's pointing me in some direction? What did they mean to say by this? What were they trying to do here? What was their last thought as they died in this world? You know, all these kinds of questions. I was player number one in Chain World.
Well, I was going to ask because you were the primal player, the very
yes,
first
I,
one. So what was
I was
that
Adam,
like?
I guess. Right? Yeah, so it was a wrenching experience. I had my, he was like 7 at the time. My oldest child, Mez, he had been playing this game Minecraft. And so when I was developing this modification of Minecraft called Chain World, he was all excited about this and everything. So he was sitting next to me and kind of giving me ideas while I played as the first player. And, you know, we had barely done anything. We had left a few little landmarks trying to lead someone toward the cave we were going to have our first dwelling in and so on, so that they'd at least find where we had been living and what we'd been stashing there. And as we were digging out our cave on the first night, we'd only been playing for about 5 minutes. We dug through a wall and fell into a pit in the cave where there was an opening that we weren't aware of. And there was a bunch of spiders in there that killed us.
Oh, no.
And then at that point, I was like, okay. That's part of the sort of excitement of building this religion around this, because people are going to try, they're going to have all these grand plans, right? They want to build this monument and they want to build it to work this way and that way. And then something will happen to them and they'll slip up and fall into lava or whatever. And it'll be over. And they'll be like, no, I didn't get to finish my pyramid.
Yeah, but normally you can respawn, right, and come back.
Normally you can respawn. But if you follow the rules of the religion in this game, you can't. And at that point, my child Mez said, okay, no, let's restart. We'll do it over again. I'm like, no, the rules say that we have to stop and take the stick out. And he started crying. He was wrestling with me, trying to grab the stick out of the computer so he could smash it. To
wow.
Force me to start over again. He's like, we didn't leave anything for them to discover. You know, what? They're not going to find anything. We only left a few blocks there. The point, they're not even going to find our cave.
Oh, wow. Talk about a primal experience of mortality. That's what we're all afraid of, right? That we won't have left a trace.
Right. And so then I had this USB stick in my hand that had this very pretty much naturalistic world, but very partially modified by me, much less than I wanted to, ready to go, ready to take to the Game Developers Conference and present in this talk.
So I've seen the video of this talk, and here you are at this big conference, and you announce the game, and you're holding the only copy in existence, this little USB drive, and you hand it to one person, this guy who stands up out of the audience. What did you think would happen then?
The story gets very convoluted and complicated from this point on. But he didn't actually stand up out of the audience. He hobbled up. Much of my friends were in the audience saying, oh, hand it to me. I want it. I'll do it, Jason. I was like, no, it can't be a friend. And then the guy in the front row with a walker, literally dragging his feet, to me, it looked like somebody who had survived polio, came hobbling up almost like at an Ernest Angley, you know, healing and reached his hand up to the podium. And at that point, what could I do, right? So I handed it to him.
You hand him the sacred ark.
Yeah, so
of the
I
game.
Didn't know. I mean, I just thought, okay, he'll play it, he'll pass it on and so on. But as it turns out, he was sort of an entrepreneur / self-promoter / con artist who actually had no injury. He just happened to have the walker with him that day and claims to have been injured in a Dance Dance Revolution contest the night before or something. But, you know, isn't crippled, doesn't have any trouble walking. He just was dragging his feet with his walker. Just, I don't know why, that day in the front row. And it was perfect because he got the USB stick and then he turned it into this giant, charity auction and all this other stuff that drove everybody mad. And you know.
Wait. So you have to describe what he did. So instead of playing the game in this quiet cult-like way you designed...
He sort of served as, I don't know, Martin Luther pounding theses on the church door or something. But as the very first prophet, right? He kind of perverted it in a way that angered a lot of people because he played it himself and then he said, I'm going to auction this off for the purpose of charity to the next player. And he put it up on eBay with the prescription that whoever wins the auction would then pass it on to a predefined celebrity. And then after that, the celebrity would auction it off again and get passed on to another celebrity. So there'd be these game design celebrities like Will Wright, creator of The Sims, and Jane McGonigal, a big alternative reality game proponent and Reality is Broken author. These people would be interleaved with the sort of unwashed masses who get to finally win this thing by paying a lot of money in an auction. So you might get to play right after Will Wright, right?
The analogy to religion is so perfect, right? Because what happened is people began arguing over the primal text and the rules and the creator's intentions and who was being truer to the creator's intent and so on, that became a religion.
Yeah. I mean, so in that way, it sort of grew into much more of a religion than I could have been, you know, it's sort of the ultimate perfect scenario.
Well, in the meantime, this guy who got it, I can't remember his name, Mr. G.
Zsa Zsi.
So in the meantime, he released these videos on YouTube in which he seemed to see himself as Frodo in The Lord of the Rings. He talked about how this drive was such a burden. He was wearing it on a stick around his neck. And then there's a point at which he seems to throw it into a giant pit of lava.
Yeah. You know, I think there was a lot of theater that he was conducting. I don't think he threw the stick into the volcano. He was in Hawaii. He went to Hawaii shortly after the Game Developers Conference, and then he was going to this commune where there are all these sort of spiritual gurus living. And then he was up on the rim of this volcano throwing the memory stick in, and there's all this stuff that he kind of released, him climbing trees. And when I saw him climbing trees, that's when I realized that, wait a minute, this guy, he was using a walker. How's he climbing trees? So that's when that kind of house of cards kind of tumbled down.
Wow. I was going to ask, do you know where Chain World is right now, or even if it's still in this world?
As far as I know, it was bought in the charity auction for $3,300 by a mysterious, well, I guess the gender has been identified as a woman, a mysterious woman who apparently has a lot of money, enough money to spend on something like this. And that person has an anonymous Twitter role that they occasionally post on. And as far as I know, that person has not passed the memory stick on to anybody else. Maybe no one has expressed enough interest yet.
And as the god of your religion, have you ever been tempted to, I don't know, issue a new set of commandments or be the voice from the clouds saying, you know?
The burning bush?
Yes, pass, Chain World on.
No, I just sort of sit quietly and watch from the clouds, I guess. From the cloud, I should say.
Jason Rohrer is the designer of scores of games, including Chain World, and Strange Champ spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For more information on We Are All Connected, please go to our website at ttbook.org. Follow us on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter. The handle's @ttbook1. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Anne Strainchamps. This week's theme music was remixed by Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.